From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In 2006, in rugged northern Afghanistan, 14 miles from the border with Pakistan, in a location surrounded by steep mountains and Afghans determined to see American efforts fail, the U.S. military set up Combat Outpost Keating. Its trouble was endless, the price of its defense high, its ultimate value unclear. In October 2009, 300 Taliban fighters attacked the outpost, leaving 8 American soldiers dead and 22 wounded. Keating was closed, abandoned, and then bombed into rubble by U.S. planes to keep it from the enemy. ABC News White House correspondent Jake Tapper tells the story of the terrible price paid for maybe nothing in his new book, The Outpost. This hour, On Point, Jake Tapper on Washington, Afghanistan, and the price paid on the ground. You can join the conversation. What's your question for Jake Tapper on David Petraeus, General John Allen, President Obama's second term, and the war behind it all? Do you know the price we've paid in Afghanistan? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is Jake Tapper, senior White House correspondent for ABC News. He's been a very plugged-in resource for us through Obama's first term, joining us from Washington and tarmacs around the world. He's all over the big issues in Washington right now. His new book on U.S. troops in Afghanistan is The Outpost, An Untold Story of American Valor. Jake Tapper, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks so much for having me.
We're going to go with you into the mountains of Afghanistan and hear this story, but give us a heads up first on all this stuff flying around in Washington right now, if you'd be good enough, Jake, and then we'll dive into those mountains. Here we have first David Petraeus, who of course led U.S. troops and NATO in Afghanistan, and then his one-time second-in-command, now John Allen, seems to be caught up in this. Petraeus's was an affair. What's going on with General Allen, Jake?
Well, the Pentagon investigators say that there are between 20 and 30,000 pages of communication that General Allen had with this other woman who has been tied into the Petraeus affair in Tampa, Florida, and that they may constitute inappropriate contact. General Allen, sources close to General Allen say there was no affair and he has done nothing wrong, but apparently this is serious enough that President Obama has withdrawn his nomination to command ISAF, and he looks like he's in some trouble. It's one of the strangest stories to take hold in Washington since I've been there for, I guess, since 1993. Mm. It's just people known for excellence and discipline revealing anything but. It started with General Petraeus, yeah. And now it's seeping down into other generals.
Tens of thousands of pages of emails. This is confusing to many people. I mean, inappropriate is the word put on them. That can mean so many things these days. I mean, with the Petraeus story right behind it, our first thoughts maybe go to sexual, but maybe that's not what it is. Are we talking a security breach, or is this just, you know, sort of sex talk? But how could that be tens of thousands of pages?
Well, I mean, one of the ways it could be tens of thousands of pages is if an email, when you have an email chain and you just reply to that email and then, you know, every email on that chain
yeah.
repeats itself and those pages could be added, I suppose. But it's strange, and knowing a lot of troops now from having reported this book, I
yes.
have to say that they shake their heads when they hear these stories because, first of all, inappropriate behavior is not tolerated in the military for privates and specialists
right.
and captains and majors. So the idea that these generals are engaging in it is quite stunning. And then I think what we're getting into here, well, there are two parts of the story. Mm-hmm. One is there's a strange question of why the FBI was conducting surveillance on General Petraeus because of email sent by the woman with whom he was having an affair, Paula Broadwell,
right,
to this other woman in Tampa, and then she supposedly had a friend in the FBI, and that launched an investigation. That just all seems very strange to me. I don't know about you, Tom, but I don't have the ability to command FBI investigations Every time somebody sends me a harassing email.
Well, I don't consort with David Petraeus and John Allen. I mean, I don't hang out with them in Tampa. I have no idea what their personal lives are like or didn't until this came out. And General Allen, Jake, is still the top U.S. NATO commander in Afghanistan, where you're writing about these troops giving it all on the ground. I mean, what a view this must make for those soldiers. It was Petraeus at the top. Now it's John Allen at the top. They must be looking up and thinking, what the heck?
Yeah, well, we had a book launch party. Party's not quite the right word, but we had a book launch on Saturday night in Washington, D.C., and a lot of the troops mentioned in the book or who served with units in the book came. And there were some Gold Star mothers who lost sons, and there was a Gold Star wife. So. And I have to say, there was a lot of talk about this. It was just Petraeus at that point, not any other generals' scandals, but it was just Petraeus, and it was just a bewilderment because these guys have to uphold the highest standards at all times, and the idea that, I mean, the thing about David Petraeus is he's a legend.
Yeah,
he is. There is no general, possibly since Eisenhower, who has been so deified, not just by the military, but by the media.
And politicians.
And politicians, absolutely. And the idea that he would do something so stupid, even if there's no national security implications of this relationship he had with his biographer, the commonality of what he did is so... It boggles the mind.
The commonness. I mean, here's his biographer. Again, you've just been talking with these soldiers. I don't know. But do soldiers in Afghanistan have a sense of their top American general there or generals swanning around in their private jets with well-built young women, you know, at their elbow? Is that freaky or did everybody know that or?
No, I mean, in the history of this outpost, Combat Outpost Keating, which is really the only thing that I can speak with any sort of expertise. In the first year, there were women at the camp,
but those were troops. Those were ground level.
Those were troops. Yes. No. They were not. They were not
perfumed biographers with slinky outfits. Well, that's what I'm just calling it like I see it here, right?
No, but perfume is the last thing that comes to mind. I mean, there were not showers
Mud.
At this place.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the women who was a cook at the camp was at our book launch on Saturday. She's a lovely young lady, but she certainly was not a perfumed biographer in a tight, clingy Hermes scarf. But so anyway, after that first rotation, that first tour, there were no women at Cop Keating from 2007 through 2009, so much so that because Afghan women were so hidden from the Americans, they would walk, they would come and they would visit a village.
Behind
the walls, come to the
edge
of a village.
Yep.
Yeah, they would be hidden. Mm-hmm. They would you know, if there was this one unit, the 191 CAF, when they had not seen women in months, it was as if they now lived on a planet that did not have women.
Yeah.
And there was one female Apache pilot, and every time she flew – or maybe it was not an Apache. Maybe she was a Chinook pilot rather. Mm-hmm. But every time she flew nearby, all the men would run into the comm shed to listen to her voice.
Oh, my gosh. Just to hear the voice
just to
of
hear
a woman
her. They were convinced she was – yeah,
chopper.
She was hot. She was definitely gorgeous. They were convinced.
They hadn't seen her, but she had to be because they needed her to be, right?
So that's the contact that many soldiers in the field in these remote outposts have with women, which is none.
Did you talk with them at all about the top brass? Did they? I mean, we know now, looking back, you know, Eisenhower. I mean, general, it's not as though it's unheard of, especially in long wars. But is that their image of their top leadership in Afghanistan? That it's got, I don't know, that they're spending the long nights emailing back to a woman in Tampa, or you know, running around Afghanistan with a hot biographer?
No. No, I mean these people are—they're directly—they respond to their chain of command, so they're responding to their first sergeant or their lieutenant. They're not thinking even at the lieutenant colonel level or the colonel level, much less general. But Petraeus was a presence in Afghanistan during my book because McChrystal was a presence.
His predecessor.
Ultimately, and McChrystal is somebody whose team very much looked at the model of Petraeus, this legendary general, as what they wanted to emulate for McChrystal, for their man. It ended up not working out for him. It's shocking that at this, you know, right now, these two modern legendary generals are so disgraced.
And to your point in this book, that we as a nation have kind of just gone about our business while people paid unbelievable price in the field in Afghanistan. I mean, this just, at your book get together, this must have driven that home even more. Here's this kind of shenanigans going on while guys are dying in bloody mud in the mountains.
Yeah, and with command decisions directly affecting their ability to live or die. I mean, when we talk about how President Bush and Secretary Rumsfeld did not send enough troops or helicopters or other assets to Afghanistan, you see the direct implications of that in the book. The decisions made because they didn't have helicopters. They're one of the reasons that this camp was put at the bottom of three steep mountains was because it was adjacent to a road. And
they needed
the
road.
That was the only way to resupply the camp because they didn't have helicopters. All the helicopters were in Iraq.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with ABC News senior White House correspondent Jake Tapper about Washington, Afghanistan, the mess with the generals and the American soldiers on the ground in Afghanistan. His new book is about them. It's called The Outpost, out today. It's about their sacrifice in an often murky war. Jake Tapper joins us today from New York. Jake, places at this outpost, where is it and why did the U.S. go there?
Tom, before I do that, I just want to correct something I said
please.
In the previous segment, which was President Obama, just to be clear, because I think I misstated it, he has put on hold General Allen's nomination to be Supreme Allied Commander of Europe. That's what the status
right.
of the presidential action.
Yep.
So sorry about that. Just want to correct myself.
Fine. John Allen in trouble. We'll see how that works out. And we'll talk about President Obama before this hour is over and the term ahead. But take us to the outpost that you're profiling here. Where was it? Why was it there, Jake?
The province is called Nuristan. And it consists of a tremendous amount of mountainous terrain, very, very dangerous mountainous terrain, some of the most beautiful land you'll ever see. Nuristan is legendary mainly because Rudyard Kipling based the man who would be king in Nuristan. At the time, it was called Kafiristan. It consists of a people that are known mythically in Afghanistan. Not only are they a distinct ethnic group, but they are known for being rebellious. They are the last ones to convert to Islam. And they were the first ones, or at least among the first ones, to take up arms against the communists and against the Soviets.
And this is way up north and east, near that Pakistan border, near the same sort of difficult terrain on the Pakistan side of that border.
Exactly. And it is an area full of, I mean, obviously mainly peace-loving people, but there are also a number of gangsters, a number of criminals, a number of people who make their livings in ways having to do with smuggling gems and timber. So the U.S. decided to set up this camp to learn more about the camp and also to keep the area and also to keep an eye on the road because so many insurgents were thought to be pouring in from Afghanistan, from Pakistan into this part of Afghanistan and then down to fight the Americans in other parts of the country. They looked for a place to put the camp. It needed to be near the road because they didn't have helicopters because all the helicopters were in Iraq. And so they found this location near a former Afghan National Police station and set up the camp. It was originally going to be a PRT, a Provincial Reconstruction Team, which is a way to develop economically the area.
And how far are we talking here from Bagram, Kabul, Bagram? Is it 100, 200, 300 miles? I'm looking.
Yeah, it's I mean, you can't drive there. It's,
no, but as the chopper flies, and they needed those choppers later, yeah?
It's about an hour and a half flight from Bagram.
So it's not quick if they're in trouble.
No.
And it was a famously difficult spot to be in. I mean, you've got a passage in the book, Jake, where you've got.
Well, this is where an intelligence analyst, this young kid, Jacob Whitaker, he's just from the Idaho National Guard. He's being asked in 2006, in the summer of 2006, to set up using maps, using topographical maps, mm-hmm. a landing zone for a helicopter. Mm-hmm. And he's looking at this place that the 10th Mountain Division wants to set up a camp, and he can't believe it. So this is the exchange he has with his boss named Ryan Lochner. Mm-hmm. So it's located at the base of a mountain peak, Whitaker asked. It didn't take a Powell or a Schwarzkopf to know that as a matter of basic military strategy, it was better to be at the top of a hill than at the bottom of a valley. Yes, Lochner said. And it's flanked by a river on the west and another river to the north, Whitaker continued. And there's no good road to get to it. They're still building that, Lochner volunteered. The Army had been coordinating efforts to build up the vulnerable and narrow path from the town of Nuray to the town of Camdish, but rain, steep cliffs, insurgent threats, and high turnover rates among the local construction workers had led to frequent delays. The road, often running along the edge of a cliff that spilled into the Landesin River, was a mere 13 feet wide at its widest, and in some spots only half that, narrower than many military vehicles. A soldier could be killed just driving on that road without ever coming into contact with a single enemy fighter. And it's an eternity away by helicopter if something goes wrong, Whitaker said. Yup, agreed Lochner. Sir, this is a really bad idea, said Whitaker. A really bad idea. Anyone we drop off there is going to die. As he said it, Whitaker thought he saw Lochner's eyes glaze over. Whitaker was known for being inquisitive and sometimes downright melodramatic, but even for him, this was an outsized response to a mission briefing. Those who worked with him understood that he always believed he was the smartest person in the room. He knew it put people off and made them less likely to listen to him when he had something especially important to say, but he was still young and had not yet learned how to check this behavior. What's the point of this base? Whitaker asked. It's on the low ground. It can't be supported in any meaningful way. The troops there will be horribly outnumbered by potential bad guys in the town next door. They can't even really go out and do anything because the rivers, the town, and the mountains will block any patrol routes. He couldn't stop himself. All they can do is die, he added.
Jake Tapper reading from his new book, The Outpost, Untold Story of American Valor. And of course, the day would come when they, a lot of them, did die. 3 years after this post set up, hundreds of Taliban descending on it from those mountains. After 3 miserable years of defending this outpost kind of in the middle of nowhere for purpose that became, was very unclear as you describe it to those on the ground very often. What exactly is your point? You've interviewed hundreds of people to do this. You have invested a lot in this. Why are you so determined to tell us in such detail about this one of many, sort of miserable outposts in Afghanistan, Jake?
Well, I became interested in the story. My son was born on October 2nd, 2009, and out of the haze in my wife's recovery room, the next day I saw the story on the news about 8 other sons being taken from this world as I held my own. And it was the attack on Combat Outpost Keating. And the story had been told and covered only in terms of why would anybody put a camp in this ridiculously vulnerable place? Mm-hmm. And it just gnawed at me and I wanted to know why. And the military did its investigation and they didn't come up with any conclusion. They ultimately said that the location of the camp had no strategic or tactical purpose. And kind of just like swept the matter under the rug.
Yeah.
But I wanted to know why. And I wanted to know more about the battle because the more I found out about the battle, the more I found out these 8 guys didn't die hiding. These 8 guys died running into battle mm-hmm. and trying to provide each other with help and ammunition and cover. The first guy killed, Private Kevin Thompson, was a mortarman. He ran out to hit the mortars to fire back. And Then I got a book contract to write about the battle, but then other soldiers who had served there started reaching out to me. They wanted their stories told too. And that's how it kind of took on the narrative arc it did, of where the combat outpost is actually the main character, the single most important protagonist. Because each year was completely different than the others. The first year they were setting up the COP to do this to make sure that the enemy coming in wasn't using those roads, wasn't dragging ammunition and supplies in a way that they could stop. The next year, there was great outreach, and They did this
counterinsurgency thing,
counterinsurgency coin, mm-hmm. which is stopping the enemy by getting in between the enemy and the local populace, winning over the local populace. And there was tremendous success in 2007, 2008.
But nobody cared up above.
Well, people cared, but they didn't understand what was going on. I mean, there were just so many conflicting views of the war by the people running the war, and every year it's different. One of the things that was interesting about the history of this outpost is that in 2008, the commander, a guy named Captain Rob Yeskes, was so good at being friends with the local population, mm-hmm. and convincing the local population to kick the enemy out of their towns that the enemy targeted him for assassination, and they killed him. With an IED, which was rare in that part of Afghanistan at that time. And at that moment, everything went to hell. Everything went to hell because that one person was so popular that his death just changed the dynamic in the valley, so that when the next team came in, 361 Cav, in May 2009, they had nothing to do. The camp was what one lieutenant colonel referred to as a self-licking ice cream cone. It only existed to defend itself. It did nothing really more than that. And then the troops there were doomed.
You know, the thing that just ate at me as I read through here was, and we all know this, but you make it real again. I mean, these are volunteer American soldiers who put their hand up, they go out, we put them in this camp, and then this war drags on year after year after year. Their struggles are unbelievable. The just day-to-day discomfort is horrible. When the fighting comes, we weren't able to adequately support them here. Many died before it was over. And then at the end, no strategic or tactical purpose is the conclusion. But their pain and sacrifice has already been made. It's already been given. And then for what? I mean, it just seems... It drives home again how you have a war, you put it on a back burner, kind of look away, but the sacrifice vividly goes on as you describe it here.
It's just, I feel like, look, these are some of the finest people I've ever met in my life, the troops that served at Keating. And then when I went last year to the local forward operating base, because obviously Keating doesn't exist anymore, so I couldn't get there, but the local
We should say, base, after it was overrun, American bombers sort of
they destroyed it.
Yeah.
They destroyed it. And there's a picture in the book of what the camp looked like after it was destroyed. It looks like the surface of the moon. Hmm. They left nothing there because they didn't want the enemy to be able to get anything that they had built or any of the weapons or any supplies left behind, because they had to leave a lot of things behind. Mm-hmm. So – but these are some of the finest people that I've ever met, and they're not being served as well as they should be. Decisions are made that are glib, and then the people – commanders stick with the decisions – for reasons that are mystifying. This camp, I was talking to one of the first captains who served there, Captain Matt Gooding, over the weekend when he visited D.C. for the book launch. He said, ultimately, looking back on it, after the 45 days when they were there to set up the provincial reconstruction team, the outreach, the economic development group, once the PRT decided this is not safe, this is not a good place for us to be, they should have just stopped. They should have just withdrawn and said, okay, that's it. We're not going to be here. There's no reason for us to be in this incredibly vulnerable position. If it's not safe enough for the civil engineers and the PRT experts, then let's go. But instead, they stayed. And while there were some successes over the years, it's difficult to look at the history of this camp and this outpost and not think, boy, they really weren't supported as well as they needed to be, and they really weren't regarded as a high enough priority. There was a team, the guys that came in 2009, Colonel Randy George and Lieutenant Colonel Brad Brown, to take over that area of operations. They wanted to shut Cop Keating down. They thought it was worthless. They went to General McChrystal and they said, please, we want to shut this cop down. And McChrystal wouldn't let them.
And so the soldiers went on. They did their duty. They suffered. And many died.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of sides to this. Sarah Chase, who we know here, of course, filed for NPR back in the day from Afghanistan, then did much more there, writes about the book in the Wall Street Journal. She says, hey, Jake, look at the Afghan side of this equation. And why was Hamid Karzai, the president of Afghanistan, so insistent that it can't be kept here, that in presidential elections here, which were widely seen as corrupt, this district produced thousands and thousands of votes more than it had people, and that there's an Afghan political backdrop to this as well here, sort of American soldiers as pawns in an inside Afghan game that really wasn't making the screen. What do you say?
Well, I have that in the book. I have the section about the town, Barajimatal, casting more votes for Karzai than there were voters. So I was kind of befuddled and surprised to see that criticism in her review. She is, of course, or was an aide to General McChrystal at the time. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't expect anything other than criticism from somebody who was with McChrystal, because the book, even though I did talk to McChrystal and I did try to tell his point of view in the book, the book's fairly critical of his decision not to allow the troops, the colonel and lieutenant colonel, to shut the camp down when they wanted to do so. They wanted to shut it down really early into their tour in the country. And McChrystal wouldn't let them for a number of considerations. Some of them perfectly legitimate. They did not have enough assets in the country to support an operation at this other town, Barajimatal, that was overrun by Taliban and also shut down the camp. Although there were people that didn't think the U.S. should get involved in the Barajimatal incident. But there were other political reasons that McChrystal didn't want to shut down the camp. Karzai didn't want the camp shut down right before the August 2009 elections. He thought it would make him look weak.
Maybe and deny also, him some of those free bogus votes as well.
Exactly. But that's in the book, so I didn't know why Sarah was saying that. And then the other thing is McChrystal and the Obama White House had gotten into a real ugly back and forth that didn't serve the troops well. And that's not only McChrystal's fault. That's also the White House's fault. But McChrystal said to Colonel George that one of the reasons he wasn't going to shut down the camp is because he didn't want to get ahead of the president. The president was coming up with his AFPAC review and strategy. And so at that point, he was being sensitive to how his how the politics were being perceived. Mm. But all that politics meant is that these eight guys died.
On that last day in 2009, hundreds of Afghan fighters coming down off those mountains and firing down from those mountains. Did they ever have a chance, the American soldiers?
Well, first of all, one of the things that is remarkable that we have to remember, and this is – I'm not trying to look at the glasses as half full, but they were so outnumbered, and there were 53 Americans. Eight of them were killed. That's a tragedy. Every one of those deaths is a tragedy. But it could have been much worse. It could have been – all 53 were killed, and it wasn't. And one of the reasons it wasn't is because these are brave troops. They ran into battle. They fought valiantly. They held off the enemy as much as they could. Now, ultimately, the enemy got inside the camp. That's how outnumbered they were. Enemy in the wire was shot. You know, somebody yelled that out on the radio. That's what anybody who had been stationed at that camp since 2006, that was the words they had been dreading. Enemy in the wire. Bad guys have come inside the camp, and they were inside the camp.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour with ABC News senior White House correspondent Jake Tapper about Washington, Afghanistan, the mess with the generals and the American soldiers on the ground. His book is about them. It's called The Outpost, an untold story of American valor. Dave's calling from Des Moines, Iowa. Dave, you're on the air with Jake Tapper.
Hey, thanks, Tom. Hey, Jake. Jake, what's up with the general staff? We're rotating these guys in, getting their tickets punched. They get a little scrambled eggs. We're doing the same thing we did in Vietnam. Is this because we are? Is this are we just trying to benefit the bottom of the line of Halliburton? Is this the military-industrial complex that we were warned about? Why is there no accountability? Why was Petraeus ostracized by the general staff when he was actually trying to wrangle this mess? And how is this playing out in national politics? I mean, Tom, I was in the Coast Guard, but anybody can see this is, you know, we're just doing this to spend money. What's the bottom line? When do we win? When do we leave?
Well, let me give it to Jake. Let me give it to Jake. What do you say, Jake Tepper?
A lot of questions in that. I would say, I mean, right now, the U.S. conventional forces are scheduled to leave and be out of the country by 2014. But I think it's entirely likely and if not probable that we'll be, there will be special forces troops that stay behind to continue to do operations going after insurgents. I would also be surprised if the U.S. did not have some sort of component that provides logistical support to the Afghans, because one of the big problems, although it's not that sexy, one of the big problems that the Afghan National Army and the Afghan National Police have had as they've been arming up and training is the support for them has really been subpar. The helicopters and the medevacs and the logistics. There was one time actually when I was embedded with a medevac unit in Afghanistan, they went to pick up wounded Afghan Border Patrol guard who had been wounded in an attack, and we flew, we picked them up, we then flew to an Afghan base to drop him off to be treated. We sat on the tarmac for half an hour, 45 minutes as we waited for the Afghans to, I don't know what we were waiting for, but for them to get in an ambulance and come and pick up this wounded man, one of their own. It just took forever. It was maddening. And we were just sitting there on the tarmac waiting for them to come and pick them up.
But is the U.S. really going to continue to provide all that kind of infrastructure and support? I thought that Joe Biden's kind of tone is we're out of there. It's their country. They've got to handle it.
I don't know. I mean, we'll have to see. But I would be surprised if there wasn't some component of assistance, maybe through NATO, as opposed to just the U.S. doing it alone. But I'd be surprised if there wasn't some sort of logistical support, because I don't know that they're capable of doing it on their own at this point. I'm not advocating that we should. I'm just saying that's what I guess would happen.
And Dave's bigger question, you know, why? Why are we there? Is it a vital national security thing? Is it entropy? We're there, so we're there. Is it pocket lining?
Yeah, to a degree it is. We're here because we're here because we're here because we're here. I mean, there. I don't know how much of pocket lining is going on by Americans. Certainly there's a lot of it going on by Afghans, and I imagine some of the private contractors are making a lot of money. But, you know, obviously we got involved in the war because of the attacks on 9/11. One of the weird things, though, in my book is that al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden are barely mentioned. The enemy is from Pakistan in all of these instances. And also their locals. They're local Afghans and Nuristanis who are trying to kill Americans. And that's who the enemy is now. We're not fighting al-Qaeda there. We're fighting locals and we're fighting Pakistanis. And that's one of the things that has become a problem with this war. And it's one of the issues. I try to stay away from too many sweeping conclusions about the lessons to be learned from this book. The book is to tell the stories of these soldiers and for, you know, you as a reader and me as a reporter to understand the war a little bit better, understand these incredible Americans and what they go through for us. But one of the sweeping conclusions that I could not escape making is that however you spin it, the Army has an inertia of thinking. They do something, and therefore it stays. I actually asked at the end of the book, I asked President Obama at a press conference he was having in Chicago as he met with NATO countries and made plans to end the war or end U.S. involvement in the war. I solicited questions from many of the soldiers and family members in the book, and President Obama called on me, and I read him two of those questions. And one of them, he kind of hinted that he had a concern about this as well, which is the idea that no matter what task you give the Army, they'll say, yes, we can do it. We will do it. And it's one of the things that we love about our soldiers is that whatever task, whatever impossible mission we give them—
Don't abuse that.
Yeah, but the point is that thinking means that sometimes there is a reluctance to shut down a camp that was put in an indefensible place or— Look, the camp was put there in 2006 because of its proximity to the road, by 2007, they weren't using the road anymore. It had become so dangerous. So the whole point of putting the camp there was now discarded.
But there it was at the base of those three mountains, still utterly vulnerable. Let me get one more if I may, Jake. Omaha, Nebraska. Kim is calling. Kim, you're on with Jake Tapper.
Hi there, Tom. Hi. Outpost Keating is among several horribly placed bases. You also have forward operating base Salerno that's had insurgents in the wire at least twice in the past decade, once where the insurgents acquired U.S. uniforms and stormed the gates. And they are mortared so frequently that its nickname is Rocket City.
Did you serve in Afghanistan, Kim, or have family?
No, my husband has.
So you know of what you speak. Kim, thanks for that. Jake, is it something about the terrain? Afghanistan is, you know, such rugged terrain that you can't help but have bad locations, or
Salerno's Salerno's actually in the south of the country. It's a little different there. Salerno's actually where the book starts. They're pushing from FOB Salerno, forward operating base Salerno, up north. There are a lot of camps that are put in places that are very precarious. One of the themes in the book is that starting in 2008, the Taliban starts doing these overwhelming attacks on these small, vulnerable bases. One of them, I'm sure you've heard of, it's Wanat, also in Nuristan. That base was only a few days old when it was attacked, and 9 Americans were killed. In Wanat, in Nuristan. There's also an attack at a place called Bari Alai, which is also in that area. I think it might actually be in Konar province. But the overwhelming force of Afghan insurgents or
big
Pakistani
attacks.
Insurgents or whoever they are going after these small bases, it happened over and over again.
And let's not ever forget that. Jim in Newtown, Connecticut. Jim, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. Jake Tapper. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. Jake, I wonder if you could comment on the fact that last month the UN's special rapporteur on counterterrorism and human rights, he announced that the Human Rights Council at the UN may likely initiate an investigation into civilian deaths caused by the CIA and U.S. military drone strikes and other targeted killing programs. And he said that if certain allegations against the U.S. prove true, he would consider them serious enough to call them war crimes. This is Ben Emmerson, who gave a speech at Harvard.
Mm-hmm.
And my concern is, it's been alleged that at least 50 civilians were killed in follow-up strikes since Obama took office, when they had gone to help victims of and more than 20 civilians have also been attacked in deliberate strikes on funerals and mourners. Now, there's a lack of information, too, so it's hard to know what's true, but this is of great concern, and I'm concerned about the repercussions. I wonder if you could speak to that.
Jim, I appreciate that. I mean, it's not only Americans in a base in the mountains who can feel under siege. I mean, lots of Pakistanis have felt under siege from Americans' drone program. What about it, Jake?
Well, I agree. I've been asking questions about the drone program for a long time. There is obviously a great reluctance to talk about it by the White House and by the CIA and others. I will say that one of the reasons why the administration has embraced drones as much as they have is because it is a way to wage this war without putting our sons and daughters in vulnerable positions in Afghanistan. If our troops can sit in a console in New Mexico and steer these drones and kill bad guys, and unfortunately also sometimes some innocents, fewer Americans die, and it is probably cheaper as well. And that is one of the reasons why so many people are concerned about this drone program, which is not publicly discussed as much as it should be or acknowledged as much
as it should be. I mean, you've got to be careful here, as our caller suggests, that you don't slide over into real human rights problems from the other side. I mean, you quote Kipling at the beginning of the book talking about Nuristan and say, you know, you'll be cut to pieces before you're 50 miles across the border. The people are utter brutes. But that's 19th century thinking. I mean, you don't want to just be dropping drones
right,
and having civilians go. Roger in Centerville, Iowa. Roger, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Just wanted to comment. I've been listening to your program, and And I wanted, as a Gold Star dad, I wanted to give my support to the author, Jake, for coming out with this story. More stories like this need to be written. It's a terrible, difficult thing, what we do.
Roger, where did you lose a son or daughter in Afghanistan or Iraq?
I lost my oldest son, Captain Matthew Nielsen, in Iraq on Cop Shocker on the 33rd parallel. The terrorists came in from the highway from Iran with a 12-pack of IRAMs and bombed the base. And
yeah.
I lost my son, and several others were killed and wounded.
I'm sorry for that loss, but please tell the stories, you say, Roger, so that we don't sit back here and forget.
Well, that's why I'm calling to support Jake's efforts to write these stories that need to be told. Here's a base. U.S. Army was going to turn it over to the Provisional PRC in Iraq, and it was well publicized and all these things, and the turnover was supposed to be an official day, and day and a half from my son leaving the base and 2 weeks from coming home, they chose to bomb the base, and that was it.
And a young man lost right there, a son lost right there.
Roger, so horrible. Jake, thank you, sir, and thank you for your family sacrifice. This has been the most meaningful part of the book for me, is to get to know these troops and get to know the Gold Star moms and wives and dads. They want answers. They want their sacrifices, not their sacrifices, but their lost child or husband sacrifices known. I had unbelievable cooperation. The camp is named after First Lieutenant Ben Keating, who died in November 2006 in a rollover. He was driving a light medium tactical vehicle, and the roads are so bad and dangerous that it rolled over and he was killed. And Ben's parents, Ken and Beth up in Maine, were unbelievably helpful and cooperative in telling me who their son was, sharing his email, sharing his letters so that I could get inside his head and tell his story from his point of view as he became somewhat disillusioned with the war. Mm. There was at the book launch on Saturday, there were two moms there, the mom of Stephen Mace, who died in the October 2009 attack, the mom of Michael Scusa, who died in that same attack. These are scars that will never heal. The widow of Justin Gallegos was there as well. Mm. Some of these moms are doing better than others. Some wives are doing better than others. But so few people in this country pay any sort of a price for these wars that are being fought in our name. There was a general who told me, and he's quoted in the book, although not by name, although it's a name you would know, who said he hoped that the book would make the American public, or at least those who read it, think more about how easy it is for us to go to war these days because so few of us have to do anything to pay the price.
So here we are, and we hear in that father's, that family's sacrifice, you remind us of many others, and especially in the week of Veterans Day, but all the time, and you're exactly right, we can't go to war and then sort of blot out the sacrifice. We remember it in this book. We've just come through a big election. It's amazing, all this controversy suddenly about Petraeus and General John Allen. But still, there we stand at the beginning of a new four-year term for this president you're covering. Do you see a different energy, a different outlook, a different outcome in this second term for this president, Jake?
I don't know. It's tough to say. Right now, I have been hearing some different notes of reconciliation from Republicans about both a willingness to embrace tax reform, maybe even tax increases on people who make more than $1 million a year, and also a willingness to discuss comprehensive immigration reform. Those are areas that I think, the president would like to make some progress. But President Obama's at a crossroads right now. He took office with a lot of idealism in 2009 and in a lot of ways didn't live up to what a lot of progressives and supporters thought he would do, both in terms of being bipartisan and in terms of being true to the ideals that he espoused as a candidate. In terms of, you can't dispute that he's been more transparent than predecessors, but that doesn't mean he's been as transparent as he promised he would be. Mm-hmm. So I'm not really sure what kind of presidency we're going to have in the second term. You know, obviously, as an American, I hope it's full of accomplishments and bipartisanship and you know, progress. But second terms tend to be terms where presidents retreat into their Oval Office and do what they can away from people don't tend to get more open and transparent and bipartisan in their second term. But, you know, maybe I'm wrong. We'll see what happens.
Maybe we should go out with the words of that retired general. You say we would know the name that you quote near the end of the book.
I'm not going to tell you who it was.
That's fine. He says the wars of the 21st century have been outsourced by the American people to our government in D.C. and to our military. This is a very recently retired U.S. general. With an all-volunteer force, he tells Jake Tapper, the American people are no more connected to our armed forces than the Roman citizens were to the legionnaires. And now we even pay for wars with tax cuts. So whose war and whose army is it? Jake Tapper's new book, The Outpost, reminds us of the sacrifices that have been and are being made. Jake, thank you very much for being with us this hour.
Tom, it's been an honor. Thank you, sir.
Jake Tapper, author of The Outpost, An Untold Story of American Valor. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us today. This is On Point.